Welcome to Clinical Conversations. I'm your host, Joe Elia, and I'm joined by co-host Dr. Ali Raja of the Mass General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Back in March, Ali and I interviewed an emergency medicine physician from Broward County, Florida. Back then, Broward had just over 600 cases, and as of this afternoon, August 2nd, confirmed cases there stand at nearly 100-fold higher at some 58,000, with some 750 dead. So we're checking back in with Dr. Julian Flores, who is still working there in Broward County as an emergency medicine physician. Welcome back, Julian.
Hi, guys. Thanks again for having me.
Of course. Hi again, Julian. Thank you for chatting with us today, especially on your day off. How are you doing? What are you seeing clinically there right now?
So I'm seeing a resurgence of cases of COVID-related complications, also essentially paired up with just volume of ER patients in general. And, you know, it is in the background of us as a state in Florida pulling back the restrictions that essentially we were, quote unquote, forced to put in the first place after, you know, we were delayed related to the rest of the country in doing so, which makes it that much tougher to deal with essentially both situations, right? Because, you know, you can only increase your staff or your resources or just sort of your energy so much, right? To meet those multiple needs.
Yeah.
Hindsight's 20/20, but it's kind of hard to imagine the alternative when we're just so early still, relatively, even if it's been, since around January that we're dealing with this, it's still relatively early for us to know what trend the virus is going to take as a virus in general, us as a society, the other things that are inevitably altered as well, economics, you know, the schooling system, familiar structures, et cetera.
Back in March, I remember you telling us that although you were working in Broward County, and I understand you're also working in Miami as well now, you were living in Miami's financial district, and you told us that you saw many groups of people together in the street without masks. I'm guessing and hoping that things have changed since then.
Yes. It's essentially, it's not the stark opposite of that. I'd say something at least in the middle of those two scenarios, right, of no mask versus everyone with masks. I will say that Miami, Dade County, as a county, has implemented what I believe a fee of sorts or some sort of penalty if you are seen in public without a mask. We at least collectively have seen that as an important measure against at least the exposure or to the virus or you know, giving it to someone or transmitting it.
That makes a lot of sense. And like the rest of the country, I think we're seeing that shift. Let me take you back to March again. When we spoke, you were using one N95 mask per shift. So what about now? What's the availability of masks, of gowns, of other PPE in your experience?
Well, because I feel like, I know that even as a country, in most states, we've seen sort of a, I would say like almost like a bimodal peak in that we saw a surge. Speaking of ER volume in general, we saw a peak of COVID-related cases. We then saw, generally speaking, a dip in just ER volume in general from what you can infer most people just being scared to be at all associated with an environment that in any shape or form can expose you to a virus just by you physically being there, to now a resurgence of truly related both primary complications and secondary complications of COVID with just volume in general. Thankfully, that I feel like that sort of dip in volume and in resource utilization has allowed us to, in a way, catch up with PPE. At least I can say in my hospital, in my hospitals, and you know, speaking for other hospitals in the area as well. So I can say that the resources in the two shops I work for are thankfully there, but I can't speak, you know, for every hospital in Florida.
No, that makes sense. And you just spoke about the hospitals. What about the hospitals in total? How are ICU beds doing? Have they started bringing elective procedures back, or are they still holding out on them?
That's also, from what I know, sort of a hospital-by-hospital scenario. I know that as a state, that's not a sort of a uniform now limitation. my hospitals are allowing that to happen. Of course, there's always, I can imagine that back thought in a interventionalist mind that if it doesn't need to happen now and it doesn't harm the patient, then maybe in the spirit of just limiting exposure in general, that it can be delayed somewhat. At the very least, that's being allowed to happen.
And what about, do you have enough ICU beds? I mean,
that's also regional when thinking about Florida. There are some ICUs that I know are at easily 90-something percent capacity.
Yeah. Okay.
And if not that, at the very least, we are holding more patients in general. That's something I feel like I can more easily generalize to the state of Florida, that there are just more, you know, more patients being held in the ER secondarily to just folks either in a ICU setting or in a what we call a PCU setting, taking a little bit more time to be discharged.
Okay. How are you keeping informed? There's so much information just bouncing off the walls about these things. And I don't think that hydroxychloroquine was an issue when we first talked. But I mean, we don't need to talk about that. But there are lots of advisories out there. And you said that you had mentioned a private Facebook group in our earlier chat. Are you still active in that and finding it useful?
Yeah, definitely. I'm still a part of those, a couple of Facebook groups, private groups I mentioned before, one of them being EM Docs and the other one being the COVID-19 Alliance, Physician Alliance /APP. You know, there's always going to be a lot of mixed messages and comments that could be, in a way you could say they're true, but there could also be another truth that's mutually acceptable, right? Because as we all know, data can be presented consciously or subconsciously how we want it to be presented without altering numbers or methods as to how we acquired the data points to begin with. So, and of course, it's hard to divorce the emotional sort of drive to be presenting that data to begin with, right? And to come up with a conclusion, whether you're, you know, pro or anti anything really in general, in regards, especially in regards to the pandemic and how we're handling it and how the virus is going to be projected to continue affecting us. Essentially, at least what I do is every time I look at sort of even a study that was well done, I try to think of if any way the alternative could be true, right? And if I'm already biasing myself premeditatedly before I'm reading the study, because that's going to color how I see it going through, that's going to color how I'm going to be spreading it to my colleagues and to my friends and family. Again, we're relatively pretty early into COVID-19, you know, not every, and because of that, you can't, as much as you would like to, you can't always make a study as diverse as possible or as extrapolatable as possible, right? You can only do so much when you've been in a pandemic for what, eight months or so. Right. So they may all come from a good heart or a good sort of intention in mind. But I always try to read the opposite of sort of viewpoint or a journal that would refute that. So, you know, in many ways, when regards to things like hydroxychloroquine or certain other related medications, sometimes the safer thing, I think, going into it is to just have no opinion on it. Because sometimes we just don't know, and we can't apply every single patient, every single demographic, every single hospital to that endpoint. Because I mean, for any study in general, for any medication, the number of days that you use it matters. If you use it at the beginning, during, or after the height of the peak of symptoms, etc. So it's tricky. And I feel like we all, you know, reflexively want to have an answer, and, you know, we're not going to convey it always that ambiguously.
Yeah.
Especially if we have like an emotional drive to put that, you know, to put that home.
Or a political drive as well.
I mean, it could be either.
Yeah.
And those are mutually not exclusive either, right?
That's true. That's true. We want to believe what we want to believe. And so I think we all face that as human beings. Have you been hearing from colleagues who haven't faced a surge yet? There aren't too many places in the country that aren't. But have you heard from any, and do you have advice for them? We interviewed you in March, and now here we are in August. And what was the big lesson that you've learned over those months? If you had to give one,
yeah, I would say to my colleagues that haven't been dealing with COVID-19 related symptoms or complications as much as the rest of us, to just keep your eyes peeled, because it's hard to say that a specific ER or a specific region within Florida or within any state is going to be inherently immune to it when we're still allowing transportation within the state, across states, right? And conversely, folks that have been dealing with only COVID-19 related, pulmonary symptoms or other organ system complications, not everything is COVID-19 related either, right? We're still going to have our strokes that are just related to a vascular, complication independent of COVID, or heart attacks or trauma related complications. So I think in either extreme, we just always have to, in these times, remember to just keep our eyes peeled.
That is a great way to look at things and a good reminder for all of us. Let me ask you, Julian, we've been asking all the questions. So do you have any questions that you wish that we had asked, or a point that you'd like to make that we haven't gotten the opportunity to do yet? What's on your mind that we haven't yet covered?
I have a lot of opinions, and ironically, on a lot of COVID-related topics. And the conclusion in those opinions of mine is that I have no opinion, if that makes any sense.
It does.
Or no, I have no sort of, I can't say with legitimacy or with, pure confidence that it's one way or another. Especially something like this virus that, again, is a specific strain of coronavirus. As we're coming to know, it's not only a pulmonary-related complications. It sort of evokes all your organ systems, and any of them could be altered short-term or long-term at any given time. We're still, trying to figure that out. And with the mindset of always trying to see what the opposite team is saying, it has sobered me quite a bit when coming to terms with what I think I know, or what I want to know, and what I want to convey to the general public, all while trying to keep a word choice, a spirit of, per se, it doesn't have to be the end of the world. And at the same time, this is not something we've dealt with before at any level that you want to talk about it, at the medical level, at the societal level, political level. It's not. And I think we'd be lying to ourselves to say that it is in either way. And everything is relative. That's a main point I would want to drive home. And we have to see what terms we're talking with, what truth we're believing before we speak, and are we allowing room for that alternative explanation to be said? Because there's a lot of common ground that can be found, and sometimes it can feel weak, or it can feel sort of in a way insulting to, especially to us physicians or healthcare related folks that are the main sort of proponents to driving home knowledge of any kind of sort, to sort of quote unquote give in to that, to the other side. And again, mm-hmm. because these points touch on a lot of things besides just logic, right? It's we cannot deny that sometimes subconsciously or consciously there is a political side motive. There is a inherently sometimes, again, an emotional cord that's being strung in some way or another. So I would just like to advocate for us all sort of being honest with ourselves with what we're reading, what we're deciding to read, what we're coming out of, getting from these articles, from these posts, from the news channels. And are we leaving room for the alternative explanation? If so, are we deciding to, to paint one picture or another based on something else besides just the facts at hand of COVID-19?
Julian, we're very grateful to you for doing this with us today, and we want to extend our best to you and your colleagues, and especially to your patients. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And As I finished, I believe the last podcast we enjoyed and collaborated in together. Keep the hope, keep the positivity. I think that's at least what drives me to keep reading, keep wanting to know more for myself and my peace of mind and for our patients. Trying to leave, you know, pride aside and collaborating with coming to terms with what could be the alternative of what we've thought of to now in this and in just in medicine and in general, because again, they're not mutually exclusive, right? Especially in this sort of wave of the virus where, especially as ER doctors, where we can't afford to just see one thing or another. I mean, yeah. We're rolling the dice with every patient, with every, you know, clinical presentation. So, yeah. You know, collaboration is what's gotten us even this far.
That's a great way to end this, Julian, to remind us, all of us who are seeing patients right now in this unprecedented time, to keep an open mind and to be willing to collaborate even when we might have initial doubts. That's how we're going to really move the treatment of this disease forward. So thank you for that really important reminder.
That was our 271st episode. All are available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you through the NEJM group, and our executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Elia.
I'm Julian Flores.
And I'm Ali Raja. Thanks for listening.